The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Endocarditis and prophylaxis, infectious GI diseases, is presented by Dr. Gerald Blackburn.
Persistently positive blood cultures. Now the problem with that, as you all know, is the first time the doc gets a phone call about a positive blood culture, what does he or she do? They get put on vancomycin and call for sometimes a consult. What I want to know is, what about that repeat blood culture? So anyway, but if I was writing the question on endocarditis, I would demonstrate that the blood cultures were positive on multiple occasions. And it would be with an organism, because not all organisms are the same for this, that's associated with endocarditis, the so-called sticky organisms, the ones that like to stick to heart valves. And I would generally have a patient with underlying heart disease, pacemaker, ICD, some other intravascular device, not like a total hip, or an IVDA. And for you cardiologists out there, I can make the diagnosis without an echo. If you have an organism of the HACIC group, folks like to ask questions about this. Any of these organisms, Haemophilus, but not Haemophilus influenzae, any of the other four, Actinobacillus, Cardiobacterium, Eichenella, Kingella, in the blood, they have endocarditis until proven otherwise. That's what these organisms do. I won't read to you the modified Duke criteria. You can study these at home. You can study these any old time you want. But there is a list of the major clinical criteria. And the minor clinical criteria. And somewhere in there, in the past, they've talked about Roth spots, which I'll show you a picture of. Okay, so the combination of major and minor are the modified Duke criteria for endocarditis. And so these are the working definitions for definite, the working definitions for possible, and soft signs of endocarditis, which I like to include in my examination of a patient in one way or another if I'm worried about it. They will often present as you wonder if they have a malignancy, unexplained weight loss, unexplained anemia, elevated SED rate, elevated CRP. And on exam, you might find any or all of these. Not likely you're going to find all. And remember that Osler nodes are supposedly immune complexes. Janeway lesions are supposedly embolic. And supposedly you can actually culture them and get the organism out of them. There's raw spots on the top left. The conjunctival petechia on the top right. On the bottom was one of our patients that did everything she could to avoid medical care because she was an undocumented immigrant that had been here a long time and had no insurance and was afraid that if she surfaced, you know what would happen. The bottom right is also, if you're really unlucky, what happens when you have multiple emboli to your brain. So any of these could be part of the or the only presentation of endocarditis. Roth spots is not unique to only endocarditis, but is also described in leukemia. splinter hemorrhages. Some of these are actually from some of our patients, and some of the other so-called cutaneous manifestations, Osler nodes, Janeway lesions, in the bottom photograph. Tips of the toes, palms, are they tender, not tender? Where are they located? There, and some people think that Janeway and Osler nodes are really all sort of variations on the same thing. So what would I tell you as in closing about endocarditis? Anytime you hear anyone talk about Staph aureus in particular or MRSA pneumonia in an IVDA, that ain't pneumonia. That's right-sided endocarditis with embolic phenomena to the lung. Every one of you should know about strep bovis, as I mentioned, being associated with a GI malignancy. Originally, it was strep bovis endocarditis associated with colon cancer. Now it's strep bovis bacteremia, or Galalyticus is the new name, or spinoff from that. And it's any GI malignancy. I mentioned any positive blood culture with a HACIC group. And the most agreed upon indication for surgery, this is sort of a tricky area because it depends on who you talk to, but probably it's congestive heart failure. These are the folks that you take to surgery right now, because they found if you waited and treated them for the standard course of therapy, whatever that was, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, by the time you got them to surgery, that you could not get them off the table. So I don't care if they're blood culture positive. If they're in heart failure, they go to surgery. And the most common organism, which could be some question now, at least for acute endocarditis, is Staph aureus. And the reason is medical care. Basically, line infections and variations on that. Culture negative, the most common cause, prior antibiotics. Every one of those patients you see has failed their trial of a Z-Pak or Levaquin through the primary care doctor's office, and now they're showing up at the ER looking maybe like more serious infection, but the blood cultures might be negative. Or the slow-growing organisms, or the hard-to-grow organisms. Brucella and Q fever rarely have positive blood cultures. So you make those diagnoses some other way serologically. Aspergillus almost never, ever, ever has a positive blood culture. Prophylaxis. In the old days, we used to prophylax several areas that we do not anymore, including mitral valve prolapse. That was a biggie until some studies came out and showed that we probably killed more people with prophylaxis than number of cases that we prevented. That would be a good reason, I think, to stop doing that. Congenital heart disease, listed as you see on the handout, but I emphasize not mitral valve prolapse. Procedures. We used to prophylax all GI and GU procedures. That's not done anymore. We only prophylax now upper respiratory or dental manipulation. And which dental manipulation gets prophylaxed? Anything that hurts a lot or bleeds a lot. That's probably a safe way to approach that. And as I mentioned, we do not do lower GI, colon preps, anything like that. Routinely, it's not indicated. These are the standard drugs that are used. They're all within an hour of the procedure. And there's no post-procedure antibiotics. So if I were to write the question, that's what I'd be trying to tell you. One dose of something within an hour, and then nothing after. This actually makes life much easier for the dentist, because if you look at the old protocols, no dentist in their right mind would be doing some of those things, not in the office. So let's talk about infections of the GI tract, which I think if I ever get invited back, I'll make it the pre-lunch discussion. You might eat less. Foodborne illnesses. At least 50 million cases in the U.S. Anytime you have someone who says, I was home yesterday with a 24-hour flu, they probably really had a mild case, or not so mild, of food poisoning. Most of the time, we don't even know what causes it. Leafy green vegetables are probably the most common source. Why? Because at least the uncooked leafy green vegetables. So why? Because you can't sterilize lettuce. You can't sterilize all those green things in the salad bar. You can wash them, but you can't sterilize them. And the solution to that has been proposed of food irradiation. But everyone thinks that that means my head of lettuce will be glowing in the dark. So that has not gone well with the public. But these are the most common source of many of our foodborne illnesses. You think, next time you go to the supermarket, you think that this chicken has led a nice, happy life. Free range. Out there monkeying around with the roosters, laying eggs, what have you. You think that's the chicken you're having for dinner tonight. This is a chicken you're having for dinner tonight. And but the other point, it's almost enough to make me a vegetarian, and that would take a lot of work. The other point is, look at the antibiotic usage in this country. In the blue is where all our antibiotics are used. Huge, and most of them are not to treat sick animals. This is a huge, huge problem that I won't go into any further right now. Okay, hepatitis A. It was recommended that I put this in there. You guys remember the old graph that you saw in medical school? You're going to see it again. Very, very common. In my opinion, everyone on the planet should be immunized to Hep A. Anyone want to put their hand up who is sure they've not gotten hepatitis A vaccine? No one brave enough? Okay. Absolutely. There's no reason not to get hepatitis A vaccine. Why not? Or why? Because this is a fecal oral spread virus, and it's spread by water, but also by food, and none of you have a clue where your food just came from. And even if you did, what's that mean? So we've had hepatitis A outbreaks from strawberries in California. So these are not all imported foods. It's just out there. So for you or your patients not to get hepatitis A vaccine, I think you're crazy. Even if you don't travel, the food comes to you. How's the diagnosis made for acute Hep A? IgM antibody. How contagious? From the incubation period until a week after you turn yellow. This is not something you as adults want to have. Kids do very, very well with hepatitis A. Most of them are not even ill. There was a study in a child care center that for every kid that was ill with hepatitis A, 28 other kids were acutely infected and weren't even ill. And guess what they did when they come home to mom and dad? So it's the parents that get sick, and the older you are, this actually has some degree of mortality associated with it. So this is a curve we all had in med school. And as far as I know, it still is true. So sort of look at that. When are you contagious? When does the IgG pop up? When does the IgM go away? Because that could be on the boards in yellow. Hepatitis E. Most people don't know this, but hepatitis E is the most common cause of acute hepatitis in the world. And I have GI people that look at me and have said, what's hepatitis E? So there's four different strains of hepatitis E, which I will not even touch on here. But I'll tell you the association that you need to know about is a high mortality in pregnancy. So if I were to write a question, it would be about just that. Well, what about C. diff? You've all been to more lectures on C. diff than any human being would want to go to. So I won't talk about it very much other than it looks like colonization of non-toxigenic strains protect against infection. And if I were to write a question, I suppose it might be about the NAP1027 strain. That's the so-called hypervirulent strain. And this is the prototype, if you will, of the reaction when we see things happen across in areas that are not our part of the country. This was originally described in Canada. I can't remember if it was Ottawa or Toronto. And so what do you think the people in Michigan said? That's Canada. Hello, have you gotten a map out? Do you realize how close these cities are? So Michigan looked at their C. diff, and sure enough, they had plenty of this. This is a hypervirulent strain, highly lethal, particularly in elderly people, and has been said to make 17 times the amount of toxin that the non-NAP1 strain makes. So I might ask a question about that. The younger you are, the less likely you've seen something like this. To the left is a normal colon. To the top right is a typical bad case of C. diff, that term pseudomembranous. There's the pseudomembranes. And on the bottom right is the result of a really bad case where a patient went for colectomy. The elderly, the immunocompromised, are more likely, especially if they're hit with this NAP1 strain, to suffer these kind of consequences. So how do you get it? Well, first you have to be exposed to the spores. Under what circumstances? All those listed here. One of the questions might be the ideal way to wash your hands. The alcohol-based dispensers that we all use all day long are not as good as soap and water for either C. diff or for norovirus. I don't know if I'd really ask a question about that, but those are the answers if you did. What about older age, antibiotics? Levaquin or other quinolones are probably the factor in C. diff. In the old days, it was clindamycin. That was the original antibiotic that was used like candy by primary care docs in the office. And all the other risk factors listed here, in particular PPIs and maybe even NSAIDs. Let me go back for a second. Look at that bottom line. It may be that the reason people get C. diff or don't is that their immune system is that they cannot generate antibodies. Because if you think about it, everyone here in the audience has been around a million cases of C. diff. How many of you have actually come down with C. diff? I don't want to know, but I'm sure not many. So why not? There's got to be something more than just exposure. And I think it's the genetic inability to make antibody against the toxin. How's the diagnosis made? Well, most hospitals have gone to PCR. We did because we thought the older tests were so bad that we ordered them but ignored the results anyway. And if we thought they had diarrhea, we just treated them for C. diff. And then came along this great test called PCR for C. diff. And we thought this was our answer. Well, it turns out the PCR does not test for the toxin. It tests for the gene capable of making the toxin. So it turns out that you are probably now have to deal with false positives. So if you have a patient with a C. diff PCR that's positive that does not fit, like they don't have diarrhea, don't treat them. Could easily be a false positive. And what about fidaxomicin? That has only been shown, to my knowledge anyway, to maybe reduce somewhat the incidence of recurrent disease, but only in the so-called NAP1 negative strains, the non-hypervirulent strains. And then there's a million ways to treat relapse. There's a million ways to treat life-threatening C. diff. I don't know how any particular pearls related to a question I could ask. And all these things have been suggested, and we're still trying to figure out. Stool transplants are the hot topic of the day. I think what you will see in the future is not stool transplants, but some unique combination of bacteria derived from stool transplants. So you get rid of the yuck factor, and it may be two or three different bacteria or more, I don't know. But I think stool transplants will, in time, be replaced with something that's easier to work around. There's also the possibility with stool transplants that you're transplanting other characteristics. So watch out for that, because I've heard of at least one lawsuit. And the way, let me back up. It may be that when you transplant stool from a skinny person, you might actually make the recipient skinny, because that's been done in mice or some other little critter. They've also done the opposite. If they transplant stool from a overweight mouse to a skinny mouse, the skinny mouse gains weight. There's been some personality transplants associated with this, so that in animals they could actually demonstrate a change in the personality, which was actually a fear or anxiety that they could measure. So if they transplanted stool from a mouse that was sort of chill, they could get rid of that fear of heights factor in the mouse. So ideally, if you have a stool transplant yourself, you want it from a skinny person with a great personality. Good luck with that. Norovirus, extremely high attack rate. Anytime anyone tells you about puking their brains out with diarrhea going through the entire family, this is norovirus. This is hits the Disney cruise lines almost every year, the other cruise lines almost every year. And it turns out, no wonder it's so contagious. It may take as few as 18 to 1,000 particles, viral particles, to infect someone, and look at what the excretion is when you're puking your brains out with diarrhea. A million to a billion viral particles per gram of stool. This is where you tell your loved one you're on your own. It also contaminates food, water, environmental surfaces, and vomit. So when that person is vomiting, it's really sort of droplet and spread of this virus. Again, honey, you're on your own. And the other contributing factor may be that a third of people may be contagious but not symptomatic. These are non-bloody. If you've ever had it, you are not going to die, you just hope you do. And then it goes away within 12 hours to 72 hours. There's no long-term immunity. To some of the more common food poisoning, Staph aureus, 4 to 6 hours, puking your brains out, no fever, usually not much diarrhea. It is a preformed heat-stable toxin, so you can't reheat the food and cook and break down this toxin. Same thing with Bacillus cereus. So if they give you a question about this, it's going to be associated with fried rice. 4 to 6 hours, puking your brains out, no fever, no diarrhea, but that food history. Traveler's diarrhea depends on where you go, but usually they talk about enterotoxigenic E. coli from anywhere, from the food, from the water, and the current recommendations are to hold off as much as you can on treating this. If you want to prevent it, maybe rifaximin or Pepto-Bismol. When I travel, I take Pepto-Bismol tablets because they don't break in the suitcase. And then, if I remember, I might chew 4 or 6 of them a day. And the treatment is generally rifaximin is probably the drug of choice, or depending if you're in Mexico, quinolones, Asia, macrolides. But hold off if you can. Cholera. If I were to write a test today, it would be someone who had done volunteer work in Haiti, because Haiti is now the epicenter, if you will, of cholera, with in terms of where any of our folks go. Brought in there by UN peacekeepers or UN rescue people after the big earthquake several years ago, and they've not been able to get rid of it. What's cholera look like? You die of dehydration. Massive, massive, massive amounts of painless, odorless diarrhea. Listeria, really not much of a GI discussion here, other than the going on to cause more severe illness. It can cause diarrhea, but what are the food sources for Listeria? For a long time, we didn't know. And then we learned that it was unpasteurized or contaminated dairy products, including there's a recent outbreak of people drinking or getting Listeria to death from raw milk. So there's a group of individuals that think raw milk is safer for, not safer, better for you than pasteurized milk because you haven't broken down all these mysterious beneficial contents of milk. And so you can actually legitimately buy raw milk from raw milk farms, but you can also get free Listeria. And Salmonella has been associated with that as well. More commonly, hot dogs, deli meats, Mexican-style cheeses. So anything that's out there in the deli needs to be really, really, you need to be careful about who eats it. You wouldn't want anyone at risk. And that's why all our pregnant women are advised don't eat deli meats. If you have a hot dog, cook them very, very well or don't eat them. 0157H7. Anytime anyone tells you about their food poisoning or how they got sick from whatever, they'll always blame the last meal. That's more often than not the case. E. coli 0157 is actually about a 3-day incubation period. Do you remember what you ate 3 days ago? Most people don't. And most people don't think back to 3 days. But it's a 3 or 4 day incubation period. It's a bloody, painful diarrhea. The people that originally presented with this way back in the day when they didn't know what they were dealing with, when CDC and others didn't know what we were dealing with, presented with pain that they described as bad as having a child or passing a kidney stone. These people were really, really in pain with big-time blood. Usually no fever. And in children more than in adults, hemolytic uremic syndrome is not uncommon. So this is not a benign illness. And I would emphasize that the feelings are that you should not empirically give antibiotics to these folks, especially quinolones, which is one of the board questions I would write. Shigella, bloody diarrhea. Not much in the way of nausea and vomiting, but bloody diarrhea. often on a cruise ship because it's so highly contagious, or other social situations where fecal-oral transmission is possible, common, what have you, but it doesn't take many bacteria. So anyone can have it. Anyone can get Shigella. But if they are bacteremic, think about HIV, because few people with Shigella develop bacteremia. Typhoid fever, usually international travel. There is a vaccine, and some of our GI folks talk about if you do fecal leukocytes, which I've not done in ages, you will get mononuclear cells rather than polys, and that they often will present with constipation rather than diarrhea. So this isn't really a gastroenteritis. This is just a orally contracted infection, systemic infection with fever, splenomegaly, and often a relative bradycardia with a history of travel. Rose spots. If they show you this gentleman with a rash, looks to me like any other macular papular rash, but it's been described as rose spots. One of our GI guys likes to ask the question, can you culture salmonella from this? And the answer apparently is yes. And I know he has written board questions. So file that away. Non-typhi. There's a gazillion cases every year. There's a lot of people that die of this. And it's very high in East and Southeast Asia, probably because of food preparation, lack of refrigeration, all the usual culprits. Where does it come from in this country? Eggs, pooled eggs, poultry. Peanut butter has been incriminated several times. Reptiles. How many have little kids or grandkids who like to play with turtles? Or the baby chickens at Easter time? Iguanas are, I guess, sort of in as pets these days. And these folks will have diarrhea, but it's not usually bloody. Again, they should not be bacteremic. They can be, but if they're bacteremic, think about HIV. Or in the elderly person, and this is where I would write the question, in the elderly person, patient comes in with salmonella non-typhi bacteremia. Being the good, caring doctor, you treat them. They get better, and 3 weeks later, they're back, and they're bacteremic again. That patient has an endovascular infection. And as I said, if they're elderly with bacteremia, especially with Salmonella cholera suis or Typhimurium, but any of these, especially if they relapse, which is how I would write the question, they've got an endovascular infection. And often it's not the heart valve. Often it's one of their calcified vessels somewhere in their body. Lots of luck finding that. Or maybe an infected mycotic or infected abdominal aneurysm. So look beyond the heart valve, but still look within the vascular system. Vibrio, people love to ask questions about this. You should know about it. If you happen to be in New Orleans, or other places like that, and happen to go where they serve adult beverages, you will see the sign actually in the bar, which is where I took the photograph. That's the only reason I was there. And it says, warning, if you have liver disease, do not eat this junk. Do not eat raw oysters, because Vibrio vulnificus is a lethal infection with people with liver disease. They develop these bullous skin lesions, systemic collapse, and they die. It's an uncommon cause of seafood illness, but when they contract it, it's the most common cause of death from seafood-related illness. It's found in salt water. And the treatments are as listed, but A lot of people still die from this. Campylobacter, poultry, international travel. Campylobacter is very common in Southeast Asia. They can present as pseudoappendicitis. Again, if they're bacteremic, I could throw this question at you any way I want. Shigella, Salmonella, Campylobacter, if they're bacteremic, I might actually show you the patient's CBC. And what I would have in that CBC would be a low lymphocyte count that you wouldn't even pick up on unless you were looking for it. So, and that's not diagnostic for HIV, but that would sort of set the tone. Low lymphocyte count in the differential and a positive blood culture from any of these organisms. And the association with Guillain-Barré syndrome. If you have Campylobacter, the chances of getting Guillain-Barré are not very high. But flip that around. If you have Guillain-Barré, the chances of this being due to Campylobacter, even if you didn't know you were exposed, was about 16%, which is pretty remarkable. Yersinia from pork, from chitlins, from refrigerated foods, because Yersinia likes to grow at low temperatures. So putting it in the refrigerator is just like putting it in the incubator. So when you have your leftover ribs, leftover pork products, and let it sit in the back of the refrigerator for 2 weeks, the only one you want to give that to is your in-laws. It usually is just a prolonged course of diarrhea. But we've actually had patients that donated blood when they didn't even know they were sick. Donated blood. The blood was incubating Yersinia, and the person that received the blood then got a bolus of a gazillion Yersinia, and actually we had a patient die from that. Because in the blood bank, what do? They use the freshest blood first. So that unit of blood that you might get might have been in the blood bank for 2 weeks, cold temperature, incubating Yersinia. Giardia. Everyone, all the boards, med school, whatever, camping in the Rockies, but also travel to Russia. And they often ask about prolonged disease associated with IgA deficiency. Now, here's a couple questions that have been asked that I think are not borderline ridiculous, but ridiculous. But they've asked anyway. Cryptosporidium. Travel to Russia, daycare centers. It was commonly or first described that I know of in HIV patients associated with animals that had diarrhea. But it's a fecal oral. So you name the source. Prolonged watery diarrhea in HIV patients with low CD4 count. The bottom right is an acid fast stain. And they actually ask you the size of this parasite. That's why it's in yellow. I have no idea why they think that you should know that. Cyclospora is sort of the cousin of Cryptosporidium. The bottom right is an acid fast stain. You tell me the difference between that and the prior slide. And my answer is, I can't. But the size is different. So they ask the size of this. I don't know why. I don't know the point they're trying to make. But if it is a cyclospora, it's actually treatable with Bactrim. But try to memorize those size of that parasite for at least 24 hours during the time of the test. I'm not even going to talk about this. Ciguatera, they love to ask about this. Tropical fish, as described. Soon after eating one of these, you can't cook it away. So cooking the barracuda or snapper or whatever doesn't kill the toxin. And within 1 to 12 hours, what's been described as circumoral and extremity paresthesias, where the teeth feel very loose or painful, and where hot things feel cold, and cold things feel hot. And one of the natives I actually talked to, who he did one of these, what? When I mentioned ciguatera, because he thought no white guy had ever heard of it out in the area that we were at, said, yeah, and when you touch stainless steel, you get this shock-like sensation. And whether or not these treatments listed work, I don't know, but it's claimed that they do. And it's a good test question. Botulism, black tar heroin, I talked about earlier, but also anything that you eat that's not been cooked in a relatively poorly canned product, for instance. Nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, and then 18 to 36 hours later, you start noticing double vision and a descending paralysis. We had a huge outbreak in Pontiac many, many years ago from a Mexican restaurant that wanted to be authentic. So they added their family's home canned sauce on top of the pizza, or the whatever the Mexican, I guess pizza isn't Mexican, is it? On whatever they were, that was, whatever Mexican food that they were serving, they're using their homegrown, home canned salsa, and each individual there, many from Pontiac Osteopathic Hospital and the allopathic hospital down the street, wound up being patients with botulism from this canned, but poorly canned, salsa. Trichinosis has been on the board. That's why it's in yellow. From, in this country, it would be very rare to get it from pork. But that's what you all learn in med school. In this country, if you had trichinosis, the first thing I would ask about is wild game. Because the way you think those chickens look terrible, you ought to see the way pork is grown. But they're not exposed to trichinosis. However, wild game, it's out there. So there was an outbreak of trichinosis related to cougar sausage. Whatever. But it was undercooked cougar sausage. So when I see a case of trichinosis, a grand total of two that I've seen in my career, I went through all those things. Do you eat wild game? Do you have these wild game parties and where all your buddies, you know, bring over what they've killed in the last 10 years and share? So bear meat has been associated with trichinosis. So if people eat that weird stuff, ask them about it for trichinosis. And then there's some tables here that I'm far beyond my time that try to help you sort out everything I said. And if you want to leave early, you have to ask or answer, what is Blackburn's rule number two when it comes to food poisoning? You don't know this, Mary Beth? There's never been an outbreak associated with beer and French fries.